You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. On Tuesday, April 2nd, Wisconsin voters will choose a new state Supreme Court justice. This is to fill the seat being vacated by Justice Shirley Abrahamson. She announced her retirement in May of last year. Two candidates are running for the position. Both Judge Brian Hagedorn and Judge Lisa Neubauer currently serve on Wisconsin's appeals court. State Supreme Court races are officially nonpartisan, but political partisans generally take sides with Democrats backing one candidate and Republicans backing another. We'll hear from candidate Judge Lisa Neubauer in just a bit. First, Judge Brian Hagedorn joins us. He currently sits on the Wisconsin Appeals Court. Judge Hagedorn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, great to be with you, Rob.
Well, start us off, if you will, with your elevator pitch of why Wisconsin voters should elect you to the state Supreme Court.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I'm running for the Supreme Court to protect and defend the rule of law, uphold the Constitution, and protect the public. And by defending the rule of law, you know, I mean, my job as a judge is to say what the law is and not what I think the law should be. And it doesn't really matter which political party writes the laws. Same thing with the Constitution. We need to uphold the Constitution as written. That means upholding our constitutional rights, like freedom of speech, freedom of religion, the right to bear arms, and also protecting the public. You know, we do have a drug crisis hitting our state, and it's also personal to me. My youngest daughter was adopted and was born addicted to opiates, which is obviously a significant issue. So it's personal to me. I'm proud to have the support of 45 sheriffs across the state of Wisconsin, Milwaukee Police Association, also five justices from the Supreme Court. We just really need a court that is not going to be a political court, a court that's going to be focused on the law, where everybody knows that they're going to receive a decision based upon the law and not partisan considerations.
And what would you point to as your relative experience that prepares you for the court?
Well, absolutely. Well, I my background is, first of all, I'm a Wisconsin kid, born and raised here, but most of my career has been in public service. So I've clerked at our state Supreme Court. So I've been there. I've actually helped do the work itself. I've seen it. Did that for, two terms on the court. I've also was an assistant attorney general at the Department of Justice and chief legal counsel to Governor Walker. And in that capacity, I was not doing political stuff. I was on the legal side. And what I was doing in the official office was giving advice at the highest of levels. Quite frankly, I've been involved in some of the most significant cases in state history. So I really have a breadth and depth of experience, including with those big cases at the Supreme Court, you know, that my opponent does not. And then obviously I've been a judge now for several years where I've, you know, been a part of hundreds of decisions where I've been able to put my judicial philosophy into practice.
Now, as we mentioned, these races are officially nonpartisan. People don't run with a D or an R by their name, but they tend to get broken down. One side supports a candidate, one side supports another. As you mentioned, you had worked for Governor Walker, were appointed by him. Republicans, certainly, and conservatives are backing you as a candidate. What would you say to convince people that you're not, in fact, the conservative candidate in this race?
Sure. Well, you know, I've been made very clear up front, you know, I'm not running on any political agenda whatsoever. In fact, we had a debate on Tuesday, and my opponent was asked to name one decision where I've ever let my personal views, policy views, any kind impact any one of my decisions. And we worked together. We decide cases together, and she couldn't name one. And so I think that just goes to show my message isn't a message for Republicans or conservatives only. It's a message for everybody. Everybody should want seven members of the Wisconsin Supreme Court who do not have any kind of policy agenda at all. And, you know, my opponent in this race, she's upheld as a model of the justice we're both seeking to replace. And quite frankly, that justice has been somebody who's been very, very political on the bench. And I know this because I was litigating cases in the court. I was there, and I could tell you how she was going to vote on every case I had when I was representing the governor. And that's not the way things are supposed to be. We shouldn't be able to predict how people are going to vote on the basis of whether they like your client's policies or not. So I've been on the wrong side of that, and I want to make sure that never happens in the future. It never has with me, and it never will.
Talking to Judge Brian Hagedorn, one of two candidates for Wisconsin State Supreme Court. Election day is April 2nd. We'll talk to his opponent in just a few moments. This has been in the news. You lost the endorsement of the Wisconsin Realtors Association and their contributions due to concerns over your connections with a school that bans gay students, teachers, and parents. People have also pointed toward a blog post back during law school critical of homosexuality and abortion. How do you address their concerns that your personal beliefs would influence your decisions on the bench?
Well, let me begin by saying that, you know, I always treat everyone with dignity and respect. Nobody can ever point to an instance of me, you know, in my professional life or, quite frankly, in my personal life where that's not been the case. And some of the information that you just said is just flat out not true. You know, our school, it has a code of conduct that applies to staff, not teachers or students. Despite what the press keeps wanting to say, or my opponent, the lies she wants to repeat from the special interest group supporting her campaign, it's just not accurate. On my blog, even some of the points there, you know, I made legal arguments based, and this, again, these were when I was in law school, legal arguments that were tracking the arguments of Supreme Court justices. I didn't make moral arguments there. I didn't make, you know, slippery slope arguments, as has often been argued and you find in, again, these television ads that are just lying about me. Again, I would point to the fact that nobody can identify any time in my capacity as a judge where I have ever done anything other than apply the law. Nobody's critiquing my judicial record in this race because they can't. So all that we're seeing here is, quite frankly, an effort to say to someone like me who's just trying to live out my faith in my own life, you know, people of faith, go home. You can't be a part of public life. And it's shameful. You know, our Constitution says there's no religious test for public office. And unfortunately, what we see from Judge Neubauer and her allies is that they have a religious and moral creed that they want me to sign on to. And if I don't, they're now saying I'm unqualified for office. And, you know, our Constitution, on the contrary, says everyone's religious freedom is protected. So simply because I have my own faith that I live out in my own life, that doesn't mean that is a part of my judging. And again, nobody can say that it was. I'm going to protect the religious freedom of everyone, and that's been my commitment, and professionally I've lived that out.
When should state Supreme Court justices recuse themselves from a case?
Well, obviously, there's certain bright line rules. You know, I serve on the Wisconsin Judicial Commission. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has appointed me there, where we oversee the Code of Judicial Conduct. And that's the code that oversees issues like recusal, as well as lots of other issues. So I'm very well aware of the types of issues that are facing the Wisconsin court system. And we do have some clear rules on recusal. When you know, have somebody who's involved in a case or you have a personal connection to a case. You know, when it comes to financial contributions or those sorts of things, you know, my rule has been if there's a substantial contribution when a case is pending before me, I would recuse in the context of that case.
And finally, I know not to ask prospective judges about how they might rule in future cases, but looking back at the state Supreme Court history, is there a case where you think that the state Supreme Court got it wrong? You might have ruled differently.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one thing I would note here, too, is that my opponent doesn't really want to answer those sorts of questions or even talk about issues of judicial philosophy, judges she might like, citing the code of conduct. But we can talk about certain types of issues and cases. And I think voters deserve an answer. They deserve people who are going to not just throw out cliches, but are going to answer the questions. And in my answer to that, I'll give one case to that. There was a case from the mid-2000s when the court, quite frankly, had a judicial philosophy that my opponent has kind of upheld as a model. And it was a situation where it was a policy choice by the legislature dealing with tort reform and caps on certain types of damages in cases. And the Supreme Court ruled that there was no reasonable reason for having a law like that. And quite frankly, that is an irresponsible policy-oriented decision. And even if it's bad policy, it was within the rights of the legislature to do so. And the court got that one wrong. It was, quite frankly, just an exercise in raw judicial power. And that's the sort of thing that I don't want to see our courts go back to, where you have courts that just issue a veto on legislation they don't like. That's what we can't have in our courts, not on a conservative side or a liberal side or anywhere in between. We need courts are committed to saying what the law is and not what they think the law should be.
We'll leave it there for now. Judge Hagedorn, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks so much, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's Appeals Court Judge Brian Hagedorn. He's running for a seat on Wisconsin's State Supreme Court. Election day is Tuesday, April 2nd. Coming up, we'll hear from Judge Lisa Neubauer, who is running against Judge Hagedorn. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The Evers administration says Wisconsin's jobless benefit rate is less than most other states. Coming up, we'll take a look at what the governor is proposing to change. First, we continue our interviews with candidates for an open seat on Wisconsin's Supreme Court. Appeals Court Chief Judge Lisa Neubauer is running for a seat on the state Supreme Court that would replace Justice Shirley Abramson, who's retiring. Election day is Tuesday, April 2nd. We just heard from her opponent, Judge Brian Hagedorn. I spoke with Judge Neubauer earlier this week. Judge Neubauer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm so thrilled to have this opportunity to speak with you and your listeners.
Well, start us off with, we like to call it our elevator pitch. Why should the voters of Wisconsin vote for you on April 2nd?
Well, the voters should vote for me because I am really fighting for a fair, impartial, and independent court. I am experienced. I have 30 years experience in the law. I was a litigator for almost 20 before I joined the Court of Appeals in 2008. I have been elected in my district, which we hear the appeals from 12 counties around Milwaukee, twice. So this is actually my third campaign. And I have a lot of experience on the Court of Appeals and appellate position, 11 years. The Supreme Court appointed me to be chief in 2015 and 18. And what my record shows is that I am fair, impartial, and independent as a judge. And it's the kind of justice I would continue to be if I were honored to be elected by the people of our wonderful state on April 2nd.
To the issue of impartiality, these are officially nonpartisan elections, but the conventional wisdom is there are candidates who lean one way or the other. You were appointed at one point to a seat, I believe, by Governor Doyle, former Obama Attorney General Eric Holder's campaigning on behalf of you. What do you say to people who say you are, in effect, the Democratic or liberal candidate for the Supreme Court?
Well, I think it's not quite a deep enough dive into my candidacy, into me, into my judicial record. So I have very broad bipartisan support. I don't know if your listeners remember Justice Bill Bablich, but he was on our Supreme Court, and he said to me when I first ran in 08, Lisa, the best way to run a nonpartisan judicial campaign is to secure broad bipartisan support. And I have done that every single time I have run. So I now am honored to have the support of over 340 judges from around our state. And just to put that into perspective for your listeners, there are 264 circuit courts, trial courts, 16 Court of Appeals. I have 340 judges supporting me. Now, that includes retired judges because they know me. I've been in the court system for 11 years. It also includes municipal judges who are very, you know, close on the ground. It is judges from red counties and blue counties. And I have over 80 folks from law enforcement, Democratic, Republican-elected sheriffs, DAs, former DAs. And it's true whether you're in the, you know, the immediate courthouse community or whether you go beyond that. I have very broad bipartisan support. So what does that mean? It means that, number one, 98% of the endorsing judges in this race are supporting me. But what it means more importantly is that the people who know our record, that of me, that of my opponent, the people who know us, trust me to be the kind of judge I've been for 11 years, fair, impartial, independent. No thumb on the scale, no ideology, no agenda, no predetermined outcome. We have to have our people in our state have confidence that our court system is a level playing field, that anybody who walks through those doors is going to get a fair shake, that there's no predetermined outcomes, that they will be met with an open mind. And that's the kind of judge I've been. It's the kind of justice I'll continue to be if I'm honored to be elected.
When should state Supreme Court justices recuse themselves from a case?
Well, that's a really important question because there's been a lot of talk of recusal in this race. You know, the recusal rule it is not from the perspective of whether an individual judge or justice solely decides I can put my personal opinions aside. It is an analysis that comes from the perspective of the people. So the recusal analysis is, can, you know, a person or a party who comes before our court have confidence that the judge or the justice will be fair and impartial? No bias. So it is from the perspective of the people, and that's the analysis that has to go into looking at me and has to go into looking at my opponent. It also raises the question about the extraordinary amount of money that's being spent in our races. And there has been proposals to our Supreme Court to adopt a rule that is tailored or more focused on the amount of money that's been coming into our Supreme Court races over the last decade. And unfortunately, our Supreme Court decided not to even have a hearing on that issue, which I think is shameful. We need to hear from the public. And again, this is about our democracy. It's about making sure our people have confidence that our courts are there to provide justice for our people. And that is so fundamental to our democracy in this state. And I am fighting for that.
We're talking to Appeals Court Judge Lisa Neubauer about her campaign for Wisconsin's state Supreme Court. Now, I know I can't ask you about cases that are likely to come up before the state Supreme Court in the next couple of years, but looking back, is there a state Supreme Court decision that you think ruled the wrong way?
You know, I get that and other variations of the theme of that kind of question, but I'm very, I'm very committed to the concept that we have to come to every single case with an open mind. And the rules of judicial conduct really preclude me as a judge and as a candidate from opining about or, giving an opinion about any issue that might come before our court. Now, I realize your question was focused on a past case, but, you know, we get cases that have variations on the theme all the time. That's the way that the law develops. And so I am really committed to making sure that I can and will come to every single case that comes before our court with an open mind and no predetermined outcome.
Whether we're talking about courts at the federal or state level, there is concern that they've become more politicized over the years. Is that something that worries you?
Yes, and that's why I'm running, frankly, because we have to have our courts be in their rightful place in our democracy. You know, we learned about it in sixth grade or fourth grade civics, grade school civics, that, you know, we have the three branches that our founders set up, and we have the two partisan branches, and we have the nonpartisan judicial branch. And it's a great concern because we have to have our people's confidence in our courts. You know, when people come into our courts, you know, a lot of people say to me, well, how is this Supreme Court? Like, how is that ever going to impact my life? Right? But when people walk through those doors, they often have so much at stake, whether it's a victim, whether it's someone at risk of losing their liberty, their homes, their children, their livelihood, their rights. They need to know that when they walk through those doors of our courts, they are going to receive justice, not an ideology, not a predetermined outcome, no agenda, you know, just justice. And that's why I have the incredible support I have, you know, not only from 98% of the endorsing justices or judges, excuse me, but, 25 Court of Appeals judges, people who know my record, my opponent's record. I have 25 Court of Appeals judges. That's current and formers. But the formers know me because I've been on the court 11 years. I've worked with most of them. And 10 former state bar presidents wrote an op-ed to the Cap Times, former executive director of the state bar. You know, again, you know, embracing the idea that we have to have an independent, impartial judiciary.
And we'll leave it there. Judge Neubauer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Appeals Court Judge Lisa Neubauer is running for a seat on Wisconsin's State Supreme Court. That election is Tuesday, April 2nd. She's facing off against Judge Brian Hagedorn. You can learn more about both of those candidates by visiting wisconsinvote.org. Coming up, Governor Evers wants to raise unemployment benefits and make them easier for people to get. We'll look at the plans in his proposed budget, how they're being received, and how they might change things if they were put into practice. We have a conversation up on this on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can join in with your thoughts on the idea and share your own experiences if you have been on unemployment benefits at some point in your life. What do you think of the proposed changes? The governor says he wants to loosen up some obstacles, some barriers to getting those benefits. What did you see when you applied? Again, that's on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, companies will be liable for costs of a cleanup of the Fox River after a ruling in a long-running court case. Kate Archer-Kent talks to an expert on the river's ecosystem about the impacts of pollution and the long-term recovery efforts. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Now, Governor Evers wants to give state unemployment benefits a bit of a bump. As part of his proposed two-year budget, he wants to raise the maximum rate from $370 a week to $406. He also wants to make it easier for people to receive those benefits. But critics say the changes would make it too enticing to claim unemployment. They also say they're unnecessary given the near-record-low jobless rate. Sarah Halpern-Meekin is an assistant professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison. She specializes in social and welfare policy, among other areas. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what's your overall reaction to the proposal from Governor Evers to raise that cap a little bit and to lower some of those barriers?
So there's certainly some controversy surrounding this proposal. There, you know, was immediate pushback from some critics about this proposal at this time. I think it's important as we're looking at this proposal that we understand how Wisconsin's unemployment insurance system looks compared to other states. So this is a federal policy that's administered by the states, and that means there's a lot of variation state to state. So I look, you know, at what Illinois has, I look at what Minnesota has, and I see that our benefits here in Wisconsin are lower. So that's certainly something to take into account. But I think just having full and complete information about what the experience of unemployment is like for people and what the utility of unemployment insurance can be for people is important to consider.
Can you talk about how unemployment insurance works? For an individual who's unemployed, what do they do? How do they apply? How do they get accepted or rejected for unemployment coverage?
So first, I think it's important to understand that a lot of people who lose their jobs are not eligible for unemployment. So you have to have worked a certain amount. It has to be a certain type of job. So for example, I, as a professor, I'm not paid during the summer. I can't go apply for unemployment insurance in June, July, and August because I'm going to be getting a paycheck again in September. And that sort of thing applies to a lot of other people. So there are a lot of people who lose their jobs who are in much more difficult financial circumstances than I am, who can't go apply for unemployment insurance. So we're not even just talking about anyone who loses a job. But when you lose your job, you have to apply for unemployment insurance. You have to show that there were certain reasons why you lost your job. So if you are fired for certain reasons, like gross negligence or something like that, you are not eligible for unemployment insurance. Those reasons do vary state to state. And then we have a rule here in Wisconsin that's currently on hold that you need to go through drug testing. So there are various things that you have to do in addition to filing the paperwork to be able to claim that unemployment check.
And supposing a claim is approved, where does the money come from?
So it comes from the state in this case, and the money comes from employers paying into the system. So this is a tax that employers pay. And employers who let go a lot of workers are asked to pay a bit more into the system so that they are sort of making up for the fact that they are turning out a lot of unemployed people.
Talk about how unemployment insurance fits into our social and welfare safety net in general.
So unemployment insurance is one of the ways that we seek to sort of catch people when they fall so that we're not expecting everyone to walk around, you know, with 3 months of earnings in their pockets to cover themselves just in case they lose their jobs. I'm sure we can all think about what a hardship that would be for many of us to have to keep that much in savings at all times just in case we lost our jobs. So it's one of the ways we sort of work together to have a public safety net to catch people when they fall. Many of our other programs are only available to people who have more limited income. So unemployment insurance is a program, a safety net program that's available across the population, so long as you're working one of those jobs that qualifies.
And how does what someone might receive under unemployment insurance compare to what they're getting paid in their job?
It's a lot less, and it's a lot less by construction. So generally, states' rules are that you're not going to get more than 50% of your wages up to a cap. And so for higher income earners, they're going to get far less than 50% of their wages. So the caps vary quite a bit from state to state. As you said at the start, our cap currently in Wisconsin is below $400, and the proposal is to raise that to $407. As a point of comparison, we can look at Illinois, for example, where the cap is $470, and then if you have a child, it's around $650. And those are maximum weekly benefits that we're talking about here. So it's far less than many people are getting in their paychecks. And those are the maximum. So for somebody who's earning, you know, only $2,000 a month, they might be looking at $250 a week in benefits.
Does the amount take cost of living into consideration? Because a certain amount of money in one county in Wisconsin pays for a very different amount than it might in another county.
It doesn't. And that's a common issue across many of our social safety net programs, across the way that we measure poverty even in this country, is that we don't take into account those differences in cost of living oftentimes.
Talking to Sarah Halpern-Meekin, Assistant Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison, looking at Governor Evers' proposed changes to unemployment insurance, raising the weekly cap in the amount and making it a little easier to apply for and receive those benefits. Sarah, to that second point, Governor Evers talking about removing some barriers for people getting unemployment insurance. What kind of things is he talking about?
So he's talking about how long you might need to wait to get that first check. He's talking about, as I mentioned before, this drug testing requirement. And then changing some of the rules around what are acceptable circumstances for having lost your job and still qualifying for unemployment insurance.
One concern that's been raised by critics is if you make it easier to receive and you raise the amount, it could be a disincentive to someone looking for a job. Is that something that we've seen in our experience historically with unemployment insurance?
So it certainly can be the case that not having any kind of safety net will drive people back into employment more quickly. But one of the things that we like to consider is not just whether somebody is employed or not, but what is that match for that job? So are they finding a good job or just any job because they're financially desperate? And what is the loss of wages that they're experiencing between their original job and the one that they take? So when you get unemployment insurance, what it does is it allows you a little more time to search for a job that is going to be a good fit in terms of being able to provide for your family or advance your career, those sorts of things. So for me, it's not as simple as just saying, do you get a job or not? But what are those jobs? Can people support their families?
How long can someone receive unemployment insurance for?
So generally, it's 26 weeks. Again, this varies from state to state because states administer the program themselves. And people might remember that during the Great Recession, this was expanded because we had a lot of people who were experiencing long-term unemployment, which is a different situation than we see in a tight labor force, labor market like we do today.
And that's been another argument against making these particular changes now. We have this tight labor market. It is theoretically easier for people to get jobs. Should that factor into this decision of whether to change how we do unemployment insurance?
I'd say there are two things to consider there. One is if you're a person who loses your job, what you care about is, can I pay my bills next week, not how tight the labor market is. So there's the sort of immediate issue for individuals, which is not a macroeconomic question, but a how do I pay my bills question. And so the need for unemployment insurance still exists on an individual level, even in a tight labor market. But another issue to consider is that our unemployment rates vary quite a bit across the state. So when we look at northern Wisconsin, we see the unemployment rates are double what we have here in Madison, for example, or in the rest of southern Wisconsin. So when we just look at, you know, the areas right around the capital, yeah, the labor market's pretty tight. But when we look at northern Wisconsin, we see a pretty different story.
We're talking about Governor Evers' plan to increase Wisconsin's unemployment benefits with Sarah Halpern-Meekin. She is an assistant professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support the governor's proposal to boost jobless benefits? Do you think it's unnecessary given the state's low unemployment rate? Have you yourself gotten by on unemployment from the state? Tell us about that experience, applying for it, being evaluated to see if you were eligible, and how did it compare to what you got paid when you did have a job previously to maybe when you got a job afterward. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the plan in Governor Evers' proposed state budget to hike unemployment benefit caps a little bit and make them easier for people to get. Sarah Halpern-Meekin is our guest. She's an assistant professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison. Her areas of expertise include social and welfare policy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? Do you think Wisconsin is a little on the stingy side on jobless benefits, or are they about right? Are you concerned about them going up too much? And do you have personal experience as an employee or an employer with the state's unemployment system? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Karen is with us in Appleton. Karen, hello.
Hi. So I'm an employer of a small business, employer. So I have about 25 employees that work in our organization. And unfortunately, sometimes I feel like people choose to sit on unemployment and go through the motions of applying for jobs and not really follow through. If you try to post a job on one of the online job posting things, you'll get numerous people that are very overqualified or qualified, but yet you go to interview or pursue them as an employee and you get no response from them. And then if you have to let an employee go, you see that they stay on unemployment until their benefits expire, and then you hear that they're out there working again.
Karen, thanks for the call. So, Karen, concerned that, in effect, people might be gaming the system a little bit.
Well, as I said before, you know, there's a purpose to unemployment insurance, which is not just to support somebody so that they can pay their bills, but to allow them some time to find another job that's a good match. And so I'm sure it's really frustrating for an employer like Karen, who's trying to hire good employees and has to pay those, you know, the taxes for workers that she has to let go, to go through the process of filtering through applications and all those sorts of things. But we also look at what purpose the safety net serves, not just for the workers, but also for their families and ensuring that they can find a job that's a good match for them.
Thanks for that call, Karen. Before we go back to more callers, you mentioned areas with higher unemployment. You were talking about northern Wisconsin. What does unemployment insurance mean for that local economy if there's a larger than normal number of people out of work?
Right. So when somebody loses their job, we often focus on what it means for them individually, what it means for their families, but we can also think about what it means for the broader economy if they stop spending money. And so we can think about unemployment insurance for a community, as you said, where there might be higher levels of unemployment as a way of ensuring that there's still cash flowing through the local economy, that somebody can spend money at the local grocery store and put gas in the car at the gas station and make those purchases from the businesses around them so that those businesses can continue thriving, even though there might be widespread or even more limited unemployment in that community.
Karen, thanks for your call. We'll go back to our callers now. Sharon joins us in Milwaukee. Sharon, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. My comment's about, yes, you do get the $370 a week, but you have to pay taxes on that. If you take out, you know, they have to figure out if you have taxes taken out of that so you don't get stung at the end of the year, you're not even getting the $370. So to raise it up to the 406, then you might get the $370 after taxes. I mean, that's something people don't seem to consider.
Sharon, thanks for the call. Is that right? People are taxed on their unemployment insurance income?
Right. So one of the, you know, as your caller was noting, people could decide to sort of hold off and pay the price at tax time later on. Different people have different feelings about feeling the sting of taxes right now or waiting for tax time and writing a bigger check. But one of the things that that points out is we're talking about maximum benefits here, right? And so there are some people who are getting even less than the $370 now. And so, again, when we think about somebody choosing to stay out of the workforce for a while, they're getting by on a very small check. And so it's not really enabling a comfortable lifestyle, I think, as most people would consider it.
Thanks for the call, Sharon. John joins us now in Wind Lake. John, hello.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, the unemployment that we get in Wisconsin is nowhere near what other states get. I work in many different states as a construction worker. And Pennsylvania is over 600, Illinois is over 600, so is Minnesota. We're not even anywhere close. And trust me, I try never to stay on unemployment because I make a lot more than I work.
John, thanks for the call. So a couple points there. Is he right, 600-ish in Pennsylvania and some other states?
So Illinois, if you have a child, you're going to get around $650. Minnesota, we're looking at over $700, and that's not taking into account having dependents. So when we look at our neighbors, we certainly are providing lower unemployment benefits than people would get if they were living over the border one way or the other.
And John brought up something I don't usually think about with employment. He's in construction, which can be hit or miss sometimes. Sometimes you have a project for a few months, you're off for a couple weeks, couple months maybe. Is that a common use of unemployment?
So we see people who are, again, going on unemployment because they've lost a long-term job, but we also have people who might go on unemployment because they are between jobs and need to do the job search process, right? And there are limits on who can apply there. Again, it's sort of a complicated nitty-gritty of who's eligible and under what circumstances. But for some people, yes, it's just getting you between those jobs like your caller discussed.
Thanks for that call, John. We're talking about unemployment insurance and Wisconsin, some changes proposed by Governor Evers. Sarah Halpern-Meekin is with us from UW-Madison. Back to your calls now. Mary is on the line in Eau Claire. Mary, hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm concerned about the lack of job search effort that's being given by the state to help people find jobs in rural areas. I understand unemployment is lower in metropolitan areas, but for people who are seeking work in rural areas, they frequently need assistance with job matching. And years ago, there was more emphasis of coupling unemployment insurance with job matching. And as the market has tightened up, there's less opportunity to provide job matching services to these folks who are struggling in rural areas.
Mary, thanks for the call. Is that something you've been following, how we do in Wisconsin when it comes to helping match up people in unemployment, in rural areas in particular, with jobs they can get?
So it certainly can be really challenging in rural areas for people to find work. There are issues of transportation. You can think, you know, we often think about counties and what's offered in a county, but you could even be far away from the county seat where some of those services might be on offer. So doing these things in rural areas is certainly more challenging.
Thanks a lot for that call. Mike joins us now in Rusk County. Mike, hello.
Hi, I'm calling from Rusk County, but I actually live in southeast Wisconsin. And let me just say that one of the previous callers had talked about that we might be gaming the system, and that as an employer, she's have a difficult time lining things up. I'm here to tell you, as someone who's had to take unemployment because of their companies leaving the state, you know, picking up clothes in the facility and leaving the state, and being on IRS.
Oh, we're losing your line, Mike. Thanks for calling in. Not sure where we're going to end up there, but I wanted to ask, we hear, Sarah, about the impacts of unemployment on people, not just the obvious things, their finances, their financial well-being, but on health, on psychological well-being. Does unemployment insurance sway that one way or another?
So we know that unemployment, the experience of losing your job, can be really difficult for people psychologically, as you mentioned. But we also see that people's health is worse. Your risk behaviors go up when you lose a job, and your risk of illness goes up when you lose a job. And we have some research that shows that when you receive unemployment insurance, it helps to mitigate some of those negative effects on health. And with more generous unemployment insurance benefits, we see actually a reduction in smoking, so people are less stressed, and we see better health outcomes for people. So as we think about the costs to society of unemployment insurance, we can think about what we actually pay out in benefits, but we can also think about what we save from helping to ensure that people are remaining in better psychological and physical health.
In our last minute or so, Sarah, this is part of our budget in the state. That's going to be a long process. What would you encourage policymakers to be thinking about as they look at these tweaks, in effect, to our unemployment system?
So I think looking at what neighboring states are doing and looking at the research on the costs and benefits of these programs in neighboring states is always informative. I think also keeping in mind that this is not just a sort of freebie that we give to people, but a safety net that's available to workers only under certain circumstances, and one that can support the health of our communities. So making sure that people are fully informed and thinking holistically as they debate the merits of this proposal.
We'll leave it there. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Sarah Halpern-Meekin, Assistant Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison. She specializes in social and welfare policy, among other things. We talked with her about Governor Evers' budget proposal that would raise the maximum rate for unemployment benefits from $370 a week to $406. It also removes some barriers for people to qualify. You can keep weighing in on this issue on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you think about the proposal and maybe tell us about your experiences as an employer or an employee. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Wisconsin has one of the highest costs in the nation when it comes to jail inmates making phone calls. A prison advocacy group says that's an unfair burden on people in the criminal justice system. We'll find out why. A Wisconsin landmark faces an uncertain future. We'll look at the latest options for Milwaukee's Mitchell Park domes, including possible demolition and maybe a merger with another museum. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. It's starting to feel like spring. The creator of the Smitten Kitchen is back with us for some great springtime recipe ideas. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, look to the sea, or the lake anyway. Join Kate and her guests for a tour of maritime museums in Manitowoc and Door County. It's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll look at the language of Michigan's Upper Peninsula and find out how UperTalk came to be and what it says about life in the Upper Midwest. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.